Coast Radio.
Will they give their houses in preparation for the king? And they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing. They will be surprised when they hear him say, take me to the alley, take me to the afflicted one.
Hi everybody, welcome to another edition of the KBOG Soundcheck. I'm Chip Kassin. Today I interview one of Canada's foremost jazz pianist and vocalist, Juno Award winner Lila Bialy, who is based out of Toronto and has toured with Sting, Chris Botti, Suzanne Vega, and Paula Cole, amongst others. In addition to being a musician and an all-around great person, you can catch Lila streaming as she hosts CBC Radio 2's weekly Saturday night jazz radio show, which has consistently ranked as that network's most streamed program. To stream her show, type CBC Radio 2 Saturday Night Jazz. And if you want to find Lila Bialy on YouTube, her name is spelled L-A-I-L-A-B-I-A-L-I. The following interview was performed during the spring 2020 COVID-19 pandemic, when shelter-in-place orders were in effect and we were all told to physically distance from each other. This is only to explain that this interview took place over the phone with patchy audio equipment, and so audio might vary in quality as the interview progresses. You are listening to KBOG Dark Coast Radio 97.9 FM, Bandon, Oregon. The following conversation has been edited for clarity and length. Enjoy. How about the Lila, the monster that is Lila Bialy? How do you handle that? Is it crazy? To like, oh my God, person.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, this person is famous, and then there's me. You know, I'm just me.
You're so funny. Oh my gosh. Famous in my own mind.
No,
famous,
but it's true.
My little son, I've got a 9-year-old, and I just always laugh because he said, you know, we try to just really drill it into his head that, you know, because my husband's also a musician.
Yeah, he's
not
a
about
drummer.
Fame. This is about, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
It's about, you know, meaning and what we do, but he always he says, so how many fans does Katy Perry have? How many fans do you have?
I know. Well, yeah, you know what? You know the woman that plays Arya on Game of Thrones, Maisie somebody.
I'm squeamish, so I could never get into that show.
But I fell.
Say no more.
Okay. Yes. I fell in love with her one day because I saw a photograph of her where she's wearing a T-shirt that says "I'm with the drummer." You know, and I realized, oh yeah, that's right. That's the way to go, because you don't want to fall in love with the lead guitarist because you'll never win.
Yeah.
You know, you want to fall in love with the drummer because the drummer is the real guy. And he's the one that keeps things together. You know, he's the rhythm of your life. You know?
Beautiful, quotable. Now, I have to ask you, Chip, are we officially in interview mode right now? Because I want to make sure I'm recording on my end.
well, we sort of are. Yeah, it's just a conversation, right?
Okay.
You don't mind?
That's
great.
No, this is awesome. Let me fire up the devices on my end, though, so that I've got audio for you.
All right. Thank you. You know what?
And yeah,
it'll be kind of good because then I'll have some pure voice on your side rather than just on my side.
Instead of rehearsed.
Yeah. So.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Exactly. So I was going to ask about the fame. It's like, because in your family with your son,
Your son, you're just, were you mom or ma?
Oh, I'm totally mom. I'm actually still mommy. Even though he's 9, I'm still mommy with the Y on the end.
I know, and how sad it will be.
It breaks my heart.
How sad it will be when you start being mom instead of mommy. You know, it's like the separation. And I remember when my kids got to a point where I couldn't get front hugs anymore. When they get to be teenagers, you ask for a hug. You ask for a hug, and then they lean their back into you. It's like, well, that's not a hug. That's not a hug. That's your back that you're giving me for 3 seconds.
Know. It's like, well, you know, it's funny you should. Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's funny you should say that because we're homeschooling 24/7 in lockdown here.
Oh yes, of course.
And. Or not 24/7, but, you know, a solid, I don't know, eight hours out of the day. And so my husband and I, our son is just this wonderful, magical little human being, but he is high energy and he wants constant interaction and attention. So, you know, he's not going to just content himself playing with Lego for an hour on his own.
No,
and so it's like all hands on deck. And I said to Ben, my husband, I said, you know, there will come a time where we're begging for 5 words from him.
Oh,
so
yes.
Lest we forget, yes. You know what I mean?
Because I remember, right now it's I remember so talking to, I remember talking to a guy on an airplane and he told me, he goes, first, you can't wait for them to talk to you. Then you can't wait for them to stop. And then you end up, you can't wait for them to talk to you again.
Oh, right. The cycle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. It's like, you know, I've got a 22-year-old and she never talks to me. You know, thank God my 19-year-old is keeping me sane because she will answer the phone and she will text back. You know, when I'll send her a picture, she'll text back and say, oh, that's nice. She'll respond. You know, so it still makes me feel like a dad because at least I get a response from one of them.
Right, 50% success rate at the moment. Right?
Yes, you know, and I feel like there's something horribly wrong with me because the other one doesn't talk to me. But then I think of when I was in my 20s and my mom desperately wanting me to even send her a Mother's Day card, and I never understood what the big deal was. You know, I always think of me. Say, well, geez, I went for 10 years where I never talked to anyone in my family.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah. I can't complain about the 22-year-old because, well, you know, I wasn't all that good either.
And you don't realize it. Like you said, when you were that age,
you weren't thinking that way.
No, it's like,
what are they making a big deal out of it for? What's the big deal?
Right. Exactly. Yes. You're trying to become autonomous and live your separated adult life.
Okay. So now
you
remember your 20s, right?
And I do.
And nothing exists outside of your world, right? I mean, when you're in your 20s, it's your friends and your work and your life. Your life is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So did you spend your 20s in Toronto?
No, it was a mix. I mean, mostly in Toronto. I moved to New York in early 2008.
Okay.
So I was still in my 20s.
Yes.
But later 20s.
Right.
And then some really significant things happened kind of between 28 and 30, you know.
How do you...
Do
you apologize to your old friends because, like, you became famous? It's almost like, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I wanted it, but I didn't really know it was going to happen. And I just...
Well, you know, it's so... Yeah, it's still just hilarious to me to use that term because it just doesn't feel consistent with reality.
Well,
but
because
what
there's
I will
you,
say
right.
is
there's that separation between you and the famous Lila.
Well, you know, so I was busy and touring more and more, and that in that sense there was a disconnect because I had definitely had a few friends who were musicians, but. You know, a good number of them were not. And so, you know, I remember often thinking to myself, they don't understand. Like they'd say, okay, let's lock down this date. And then I'd get a gig. Or so here's a terrible, it's actually a really great and also a really awful example. So one of my dear friends got married in November of 2007. Uh-huh. And I was to be a bridesmaid. And the date was October 20th. And I had been touring on and off with Paula Cole, which was a big opportunity at that point, though. I was kind of used to being on the road with a great artist like her. Uh-huh. And she wasn't winding down, but she was shifting gears. And so then I got asked to join Suzanne Vega's band. And go figure, I get offered, you know, a three-week-long worldwide tour.
Which you can't turn down.
You can't turn down. And my friend's wedding, God bless her, was squarely in the middle. I was going to be in Marseille, France. And I made the toughest decision of my life that actually, to some degree, to this day, I still regret. Because sure. At that time, I was like, are you kidding? This is like, you know, it was like 10 grand, which back then was huge. And it was...
Isn't that funny? You know, when you start off,
the world.
If you have $1,000 in your pocket, yeah. You're rich at one point in your
right.
life.
Right. Oh, sure. Oh, my gosh. And I mean, gigs would pay, like local gigs would pay like $50 sometimes. Yeah. So this was...
And you lug know, your own equipment, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And basically lose all that money and more on the car services you have to pay to get to schlep all your stuff.
Because sure.
You can't be putting a keyboard on your back and that right. sort of, and an amp and all that in New York. So I ended up going on this tour, and it's so funny. I don't believe in karma, but I did get really sick mid-tour and had to leave the tour anyway. Uh-huh. and what was even more sad was, you know, it took a solid 5 years for that friendship to recover. Now we're fine, but right. I still think that if I'd made the decision that showed the most integrity, I would have seen that wedding through, and I would have been the bridesmaid. I gave her a month notice, but that's nothing for a bride to be, right? Like everything is,
I know,
feels like it's the world. And,
yes, oh yeah. Yes. When it's your wedding, nothing else exists, right?
It's everything. But, it's everything.
You know,
yeah.
But okay. One of the things that my father always told me was, you always have moments of regret, but you have to trust the person that you were at the time. Mm. Meaning, mm-hmm. meaning, right. of course, you can always look back. You know, hindsight's 20/20. You can always look back and yeah. say, you know, I probably should have done something different there. But at the time, you yeah. made the best decision that you could. You looked at your career. And how many
right.
opportunities were going to rise like that? You have no idea. That could be the only one. It could be.
Was the only tour I did with Suzanne Vega.
Right. It could have been the only
example.
It could have been the only opportunity that you ever had with anybody with world renown. You didn't know that, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, it is a moment of regret. We all have them. I mean, if you live a certain number of years, you're going to have moments that will haunt you for the rest of your life, right? The things you said yeah. or the things you did to certain people who were important to you. But, you know, yeah. like I always fall back on what my dad says. At the time, you make the best decision that you can, you know?
That's right. It's all you can do, as you say. I mean, it's you take stock of all the different factors in your life, and, you know, you can't know the future.
Yes.
And so you just do your best, and that's all you can do. So I do agree with you there, and thank you for that, because even, you know, gosh, almost what, 20, well, not 20 years, but 13 years
later. It still
later,
haunts you a little bit.
It's still something. Yeah, exactly. And thank God the friendship at least is intact, because she's such a dear person to me. But yeah, you know, it's one of those things. It's like a little bit of scar tissue is still there.
Yeah.
The stars, look how they shine for you, and everything you do. Yeah, they were all yellow. I came along, I wrote a song. All the things you do, and it was called yellow.
of your musical friends, though, have you ever had to sort of like hide your success? I mean, oh yeah, I'm touring with Sting. It's like, oh, what? You know, you really don't want them to know, because then they'll just be jealous of you.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess I try to keep everything in perspective. And for me, you know, it's not like false humility. When I got the gig with Sting, what I would routinely tell my fellow singers, especially because I had really just started kind of, you know, flexing that muscle as a vocalist. I really was primarily a pianist prior to that. So I've really felt like I had
Did
no
you always feel like
being...
you could be a vocalist? I mean, even at a young age, did you always think, you know, I could sing. I could, you know, maybe one day I can sing.
Yeah, I did. And people told me I could, you know, and I had this, I took just a handful of vocal lessons when I was in high school. I had this crazy Russian teacher who couldn't speak practically a lick of English. And he would just say, voh, voh. And then his wife, Olga, who did speak English, would leave my mom these protracted messages saying, your daughter is going to be a star. You know, they wanted me to be an opera singer, and I was a coloratura soprano. I fake the whole smoky alto thing as a jazz singer. I fake that. I'm actually...
Did you say coloratura
soprano.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Like ultra high, lyric soprano. Okay. So right. So queen of the night on Mozart kind of thing. But anyway, so with friends, you know, even though I knew that I had it in me to sing, I didn't know, you know, really if I could kind of hold my own professionally. So there was some awkward growing pains for a few years there. And when I got scooped up to do the gig with Sting as a singer, of all things, rather than a pianist, right, which was my dream because I was a big Kenny Kirkland fan.
Was it a surprise when they asked you to sing? Or did
yes.
you? Really? Okay.
Well, I auditioned as a singer. So that was the only option at the time. Yeah, and then he later discovered that I was a piano player, and then I had the great pleasure to both play and sing with him. But what I would tell my singer friends who were far more qualified for the gig, just in terms of pure vocal talent, you know, I would say in New York, it would not be that much of an exaggeration to suggest that there were like probably 100 more qualified singers within like a 5-block radius of my home in Brooklyn at the time.
Well, you know, qualified is a qualified term, you know,
yes,
because
exactly.
It's not skill. It's not always skill.
It's
I'm sure you've seen.
That. It's the musicianship. It's the personality.
It's the tenacity.
There are a bunch of,
you know,
yeah, exactly. That's right. And Robert Sadin, Sting's producer for that project, he was the one who, you know, ran the audition. And I have no doubt, knowing Sting now, that they were recording the whole thing. And I think that he was sending those tapes to Sting to check out. Because Sting has his hands in everything. And I say that as a high compliment. He is super hands-on and very, very involved. But anyway, I think it was the musicianship. It was that I could sight read well. I could blend well.
I think,
you know,
I think in all pursuits, including creative pursuits, there's just, they look at you, are you a professional? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you capable of doing what we ask you to do and doing it well?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in your interviews, I'm sure they saw, can she do this? Can she do this? You know, you tick off boxes. Can she do all these things? Can she respond professionally to what we throw at her? And you obviously did well.
Yeah.
And that's beyond musicianship.
Right. Yeah, and actually this could be a little tutorial for aspiring musicians because, you know, people get so fixated, young musicians get so fixated on their craft, and it often takes somebody who has the benefit of hindsight and has kind of, you know, earned some stripes in the music biz to say, you know, make sure that you work on your capacity to, like, be kind of an easy hang. Because 90% of the time, or let's say maybe 70% of the time, is off stage. You know, you're crammed onto a bus together or a plane or wherever it may be. And I actually had to work out a few kinks. When I was, I'll tell you a funny story. When I was touring with Chris Botti, that was my first gig. I was 25 and turning 26, and it was which is not that young, but it was my first kind of major gig where I was working with, you know, a world famous artist playing for audiences, you know, above 3,000. Uh-huh. And
more than the $50 gig?
Right, exactly, and the smoky bar in the corner of the Lower East Side. So I you know, was such a keener and was so like the little, you know, a golden retriever is definitely my spirit animal. So I'd be like ready to go at 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, in everybody's face. How are you? How'd you sleep? And so one day the tour manager came up to me and he pulled me aside and he said, okay, no talking before 10:30 a.m.
Before anybody's had their coffee.
Right. And they started issuing me, if we were flying, because Chris is all over creation and he still is. If we were flying from point A to point B, they actually started issuing me tickets with seats that were like at the back of the plane without, like, not with the rest of the band. And then they'd put me in the back of the van. Like, very often there'd be two vans and I'd be in the back. Now, Billy Childs and I got along, you know, like a house on fire. We were both kind of music nerds. And so that was great. And everybody else was cool, too. But I had to learn to tone it down.
Yeah.
I had to learn to give people some space to be cool.
Yes. Hopefully what that's given you is that now that you've attained some gravitas, that when you bring someone new in, you could have some sympathy for them, because for them it's the hugest thing in the world.
Right. Actually, it's, you know, gosh, you're a lovely interview. You're thinking of some unique angles, and even though I struggle to think of myself as in my mind, I'm forever an emerging artist.
Yeah.
But you know, recently we brought on someone new before COVID hit. And we brought on somebody new who is super talented, who's going to be touring internationally with me, the new record, actually. So we would have been on the road right now. And I kind of needed to debrief a little bit with my husband, who was present at rehearsals and part of the band, because there were a couple things I was just a little concerned about. And he effectively said what you just did, which is like, you know, give this person some time. Let them get their feet wet. You know, they're kind of amped up. They're excited. Right. And so in some ways, you're not getting a true picture of how that hang is going to be on the road. Because I'm not a diva, but the road is tough. And while I've got a pretty high energy, I do need things to be sort of a little bit mellow off stage, you know.
Which means you're not going to go out and party until 3 in the morning.
Right, exactly. So anyway, is there, in your world,
in your jazz world, because I know that, you know, rock and roll is famous for just you need to not only be a good musician, but you need to be able to handle drugs, because drugs are every day, you know?
It's the lifestyle. Certainly was, and probably is still.
In your area of music, do you find people a little more professional that, you know what, the gig is the gig, and then we go home? You know, and we don't need to drink all night.
Well, there's still some partying. I mean, we've definitely, Ben and I, because we've both, you know, I lead my own band, but I've also been a side man or side person, even fairly recently. And so we've both been in band situations where there might be the one band member who parties or who misses the lobby call, like, routinely. And, you know, often, I mean, depending on how the artist whose gig it is feels about that stuff, you know, it's like they might just get one chance, they might get two chances. In one instance, you know, there was a super talented musician who really, really partied, but he would always show up on time and he'd always deliver music, the music live on stage. So
he was professional.
You know, as long as he wasn't. Yeah, that's right. So we were like, okay, he's a big boy. He can handle himself.
Right.
And, you know, but everybody's threshold for those kinds of things are vary.
No, that's perfect. In my own world of technology, you know, I graded professionalism in a few different ways. You know, number one, what we already talked about is like, can I throw 20 different things at you and can you handle them? Right. If I ask you to do 20 different things, I don't care about your vertical skill sets, because in technology, too many times people just look at your vertical skill sets. What skills do you have? Mm. You know, and I always preferred to bring in people. I don't care what your skills are, but can I throw stuff at you and you'll figure it out? And it must be the equivalent in music. Like, if I play in this style, Can you play with me? If I play in this style, can you play with me? You know, and and the second gauge that I often use with people is when I ask you on a when something needs to be done. If you tell me Wednesday, I expect it to be Wednesday. You know, if I expect you to be on time, can you be on time? And those two aspects of professionalism were always the most important to me. You know, number one, can I throw anything at you? And number two, can you deliver when you're supposed to?
Yeah, yeah. So it's the two together.
Yes.
It's not just, you know, one over the other. It's they have to work synergistically because someone can do a bang up job, but if they don't deliver on time, then it may actually not even be worth anything.
Yes.
If
well,
there's a, if
well
there's
you
a
know.
Deadline, right?
Yes. I mean, how many times have you run against run up against people who fail because they're always trying to be perfect? You know, they're always trying to make the perfect song. It's like, it's never going to happen. This song will never be perfect. You have to just get it out. You know, my ex always had a saying, because she was an academic, and she always had a saying that she says, I never suffer from writer's block. I just lower my standards and keep on going. You know,
there's wisdom in that. It is as much a discipline as it is a craft and an art, right? And that's the discipline part is, how do I keep going so I can deliver what is required given the circumstances? And in a way that's, you know, going back to the earlier part of our conversation where you can only do your best. And in a way, that's the grace we're having to extend to ourselves right now in the midst of this whole COVID-19 era, right? Because it's nothing is perfect right now as musicians. And, you know, we're struggling to kind of get caught up on the technological side of things. And then even if you line up everything perfectly, you're still at the mercy of your internet connection. And you can do everything in your power to get that, you know, at sort of to the highest level. But then, you know, if it's again, that's this sort of ephemeral thing.
But maybe you also have to be okay with stumbling along the way. I mean, how many times, you know, when you approach a song, I'm sure, you say, you know what, well, we're going to put this band together. We're going to do this different. You have to expect that, well, there's going to be failures along the way, but we've done this before and we will eventually succeed.
Yeah, and actually I would also argue that you redefine what success means. So it's not even a matter of like, okay, well, that was a success, that was a failure. It's more so, okay, you know, this song had this function. It didn't check off all the boxes, but it still served a purpose.
Prends ma main et je t'emmène au-delà de toutes nos chimères, vers un monde plus beau où le chant des oiseaux n'est jamais éphémère.
There's a benefit in me researching you to the modest degree that I did. I ended up discovering.
Well, good for you.
I ended up discovering Glenn Gould, is it Gould or Gould?
Glenn Gould.
Okay, and his family was originally Gould, and when they came over, they changed to Gould because of various things. But anyway, so I end up spending like a couple hours just reading about him, you know, and how amazing he was. You know, his when I listened to his music on YouTube. Frankly, he didn't do a lot for me. Supposedly, he's amazing with Bach, right? And but the way he speaks was entrancing to me. You know, that he would when they interviewed him, you could see the mind behind him speaking. Like he would think about what he was going to say, then he would say it with such articulation and such thought behind it.
Yeah. And you know what I heard? Oh, sorry. Go ahead. No, go
ahead.
So I heard, because I work at the CBC, and CBC was heavily involved and partnered with Glenn Gould and his various, you know, projects over the years. And I heard from a few sources that even his interviews were totally scripted, but by him.
Oh,
so
really?
He would sort of premeditate it all. But I could be wrong.
No, and which is the way supposedly he handled his performances, right? He controlled everything.
Exactly.
You know, there's a famous Leonard Bernstein thing where Leonard Bernstein was going to conduct him. And he starts off in front of the audience and he says, I have to tell you that sometimes the conductor is in charge and sometimes the soloist is in charge. It's almost an apology, you know, because he was bringing Glenn Gould on, who would not listen to anybody. He did his own thing.
Right, exactly. He was behind the steering wheel, make no mistake. Yeah.
And I think he always just found his own way, path of doing things, which is why he was a bit of a Renaissance guy in his own way. Because
absolutely. And,
you know, but did you go through a Glenn Gould phase where you were studying him or?
You know, it's interesting because his playing and his approach and his whole person
is really perverse, wasn't it?
Really, yeah, I mean, it's really unique. But now it resonates with me now more than it did like in my earlier years when I was an aspiring classical pianist myself. His approach to Bach was, you know, I preferred, you know, Angela Hewitt is another kind of celebrated interpreter of Bach, and I liked her approach as an interpreter more than Glenn Gould's, because his was almost too wily for me. Like, what, you know, what is he doing? Like, too, almost like Coltrane in jazz, you know. Coltrane was such a strong voice that when I first was exposed to his music as a teenager, I was like, wow, you know, it was too much. I was overwhelmed. It'd be like having blue cheese or something, or, you know, like just a really strong flavor. And my palate was not yet developed enough to be able to really appreciate it for what it was.
Sure.
And now looking back, I really do, but it took years. It took years and years. So, you know, I feel like I'm still at the beginning of that journey of really digging deep into those, you know, the Glenn Gould archives.
Okay.
But I've done my fair share over
but
the years.
In
I
your
have.
Own...
So I love that you did that. Yeah.
Okay. In your own work though, there's always the question of accessibility to the audience, right? So when you have people in your audience, and you're more of a jazzy kind of flavor of music than what people are used to, meaning that the poppy people, the people who are used to pop music and hip hop and rock and roll, you know, and I know that you've made inroads into these other genres, but there is the question of accessibility, thinking, okay, well, these people are used to rock, they're used to pop. How do we slowly bring them into this other world that's amazing, you know? And how do you reach their ears so that they can appreciate it? And I think you've had some degree of success there because I've seen in other interviews you talking about the types of covers that you do.
Right. Yeah. That was really, I think, what enabled me to transition more into this world of the jazz hybrid with something a little more mainstream, whether it's, you want to call it indie pop, there are like elements of folk and singer-songwriter.
Right.
And the mainstream component. And I had seen other jazz musicians do this, so I was not like a trailblazer. You know, was to take songs from the mainstream. So it could be anybody from like Neil Young to Bjork, who's, you know, maybe not mainstream, but she's certainly more mainstream than.
You should meet her one day.
Oh, I would just love to.
You should meet her. Go show
it.
Knock on her door one day. Just go to Iceland or wherever it is and knock on her door.
She's in New York.
She's
in
New
York. So my friend taught her kid. And my friend teaches at a fancy private school on the Upper West Side. And Bjork's kid was in her class a few years ago. And when I released this quirky video, my friend actually showed it to her class. And she goes, Bjork's kid saw your video.
Wow.
So I thought, okay, well, I'm two steps removed. But and
that's
actually,
almost claim to fame. You know, you can say
one time,
Bjork's kid saw my video. So I'm almost famous.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, but Bjork, is she studied with, as a singer, just to maintain the health of her voice. I mean, if you can imagine, because she's just this wild singer, she studied with, you know, kind of one of the foremost vocal instructors in the city who a number of my peers were studying with. And she would go, she was a big fan of, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name. It's Shara something, the lead singer from My Brightest Diamond, which is like this kind of indie alt group in New York, in Brooklyn. And Bjork loved her, her singing. And so Bjork would show up at all her shows.
Wow.
And I had a friend who was friends, you know, would occasionally play with the band. And I just thought, oh my gosh, to be a fly on the wall or like to be seated in the same auditorium as Bjork.
You could. Yeah. I mean, you've established a bit of a name for yourself now. I'm wondering if you contacted her, whether she would talk to you.
Yeah, I mean, these people, it's interesting. Like, staying in his way was so, and is so, down to earth. And it's surprising. I mean, it's kind of amazing. You have to prove your trustworthiness to some degree with these folks, right? Because they get
Exactly. Some kooky people. I mean, you have to imagine a man like Sting has seen 1,000 musicians come and go, and he knows the people that he can rely on, right? I mean, you reach a level of competency, and you just want to work with competent people.
No, he's great. So, who knows? The Bjork thing, I have my little wish list. It's funny because they're all such different musicians, and they all have, you know, it just so happens that their names or artist names all start with B, right? Like my wish list of people I'd like to work with. It's like Bjork, Bono, Bon Iver, Bobby McFerrin.
Okay, so
And
when you do covers, is it just because a song struck you, or?
Yeah, it's a combo. So initially that was the place I was coming from. Do I like the lyric? Does the lyric resonate with me on some level? Is there something in the music I feel I can latch onto that will help me import it into a jazz leaning space, you know, where the song, the integrity of the song is still there to some degree, but I can play with it and kind of reinvent it. But then, you know, fast forward a few years and to make things interesting for myself, I started asking audience members what they wanted to hear, and there was no restriction on genre. And the danger there was, of course, I got requests for songs that A, I'd never heard of, or B, I just plain did not like.
Right.
But my commitment to the audience was, I am not gonna, you know, outside of profanity, because it's not my thing, you know, you can request any song you want to hear me reimagine. I would ask for a couple days notice, like I would do this online and say, hey, post your requests, and then a few would come in for a show and I'd be working away trying to kind of do something unique in a short period of time. And most of these were just unveiled at that particular performance, and then I'd go on to the next one and do that, and few of them actually stuck with us. But actually my last record,
because you found a hook in it, because you found a hook in the song that you liked.
Right. I could always find something. And if I really didn't like the music, what I would do is I would even sometimes strip the music away altogether. And I would have like somebody beatbox behind me while I, you know, like just was the sky was the limit in terms of the direction I could go in. And that made it actually really fun when I had more time on my hands. But anyway, so the three songs on my last record, Let's Dance, David Bowie, Yellow by Coldplay, and I Think It's Gonna Rain Today by Randy Newman, those were all fan requests. So but it's also been a way of discovering, you know, in some instances, discovering artists or new songs that, you know, you'd have to say I live under a rock to not know them, but you'd be surprised. I'm not a human encyclopedia of music or a jukebox, so I haven't heard everything under the sun.
Right.
And so it's been like a real, you know, kind of growth thing for me to open up the floor to other people's requests and to discover Hall & Oates because somebody requested She's Gone, you know.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Okay, what can I do with that, you know, and so on and so forth.
It's been a creative endeavor then as well, because it's forced you to rethink how you're going to re-express a song in your own voice.
Absolutely. Yeah, I liken it to a home renovation, right? It's like all the bones, all the bits and parts are there, and then I'm going to go in and I might take some stuff out and put in something new or rearrange things. And
but have those adventures seeped back into your own music now, because you've had to rethink how you're going to do covers. That now, when you go back to the stuff that you normally do, have you been able to incorporate some of those ideas?
Like as a writer myself, just as a songwriter?
Into your own music.
Well, yeah, well, that's actually... Yeah, so that... It's funny. I mean, again, another great question. I did a little Zoom, sort of private Zoom conference thing where I performed and people were able to ask questions, and one of them asked about the songwriting process, and I feel like such a fledgling as a songwriter. But I do think that, you know, that process of covering other people's music, but trying to reimagine those songs has helped me kind of acquire by osmosis ideas and new skills in terms of my own songwriting. So I encouraged him to do that. I said, you know, if you have the skills to transcribe something and then, you know, just tweak and change a few things and you'll get your own creative juices flowing in tandem with all this wonderful raw material.
Yes. You know what amazes me is I'm self-taught on the piano, and so I...
Oh, cool.
I play by ear. So what I'll do is I'll hear songs that I like and I'll sort of just figure them out on the piano. But, you know, as you know, there's standard chord progressions, right? There's C, E minor, F, G, you know, there's C, A minor, G, F, you know, the standard chord progressions. And when I hear a song that I really like and I sit down and I figure it out, it's like, oh my God, that's not standard. How did they do, how could a human mind come up with something like that? You know?
Right.
You know, I remember figuring out, what's that song? There's a Place for Us from West Side Story, you know?
Oh, and beautiful.
Yeah, and the chords just aren't, they're not standard chord progressions. And it just like blew my mind. It's like, how did Leonard Bernstein come up with that? How did he do that?
He's one of the great, so that's, I'm super drawn to Bernstein and Sondheim for those reasons, because they write songs that are like so kind of catchy and memorable right from the get-go. And yet in the harmonic accompaniment, there are twists in the tail. I mean, there are like,
and you think, how did they come up with that? How is a person able to come up with that? You know?
Well, yeah, in their instance, I mean, I heard, so I'm a big fan of Terry Gross and her.
Yes,
her NPR show
we all love her.
We all love her. And she had a two-part interview with Sondheim, and it was, you know, and of course she's done many with Bernstein as well. And she asks those kinds of probing questions about his process and so on. And you know, it's really interesting, and everybody's different, but in his case, it's like there's this whole breadth of classical knowledge and theoretical knowledge that does inform the decisions that he makes. So there's an intellectual component, but of course, he has this crazy unique ear and imagination that kind of absorbs all these sounds that he's been listening to since he was a baby, and he's able to kind of reinvent the wheel for himself musically and create his own language that now others are emulating, right? Sure. And he's kind of one of those once in a lifetime guys.
Yeah. Broken windows and empty hallways, a pale thin moon in a sky streaked with gray. Humankindness is overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today.
How does your family treat you now? Are you like this like weird monster, this weird person? That, oh, she's always she's always on the road. We never know where she is.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, it's funny. So I have three older sisters, and mm-hmm. the eldest sister, so I'm the baby, and
so
my
oldest anomaly?
Sister, Susan.
Yes.
Well, it's so funny. She is a doctor. She was going to become an ER surgeon. She left that 1 year short of completing her residency and moved to Mexico, became a professional salsa dancer, then switched to flamenco, and then started writing and speaking and coaching. And she, in many ways, is better known than I am. She writes articles for Psychology Today.
I have to tell you,
like hundreds of thousands of hits.
I have to tell you, just after hearing the story about your sister and you, I love your parents.
Yeah.
I love your parents. Whatever they did to raise you guys that way was perfect. You know, just
well, they you know what? They're long suffering. I mean, they wanted. I was going to go into sciences and follow in Susan's footsteps.
I know. You had some scholarship.
You know the story.
You had a scholarship
exactly.
for the sciences.
Gosh,
right?
You're good. You're okay. right to go to the University of British Columbia. But anyway, so they've been, but they've never stood in the way. They've questioned us, but they've never said no. You know, we forbid you. You know, or do not do it. They just, it's been more about what, you know, okay, you know, we want you to be able to provide for your family. We want you to be able to have a roof over your heads. We care about your safety
right.
and your well-being. But we know that a big part of that is, you know, how meaningful an experience you have in this life. And if your means to that, you know, fulfilling life is through music and you can kind of make it work in your way and not come undone, then more power to you. So in a way, that's where my parents, you know, that's been their stance throughout my life. I feel like Susan, because she was the eldest, probably had some more roadblocks and was pushed maybe
expectations,
a
yes.
to take the traditional path. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. So yeah. With your son, of course, you know, everything comes full circle, right? That suddenly you're raising this other human being. And
yeah.
You know, one of the things I always try to do with my kids, because, you know, kids have 1,000 different interests. And if you show an interest in something and if you show that you're willing to work at it, I will support you in any way you want. You know, if you know, I'll buy you the skates. My daughter spent a year shoveling goat poop out of sheds before we allowed her, let her have a goat, you know. Show that you.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome!
You know, show that you want to work at it. If you decide to work at something, we will be glad to support you in any way you want to. Right.
I think we could take a leaf out of your book because we have been too quick to, you know, if he shows an interest in something, to kind of immediately do everything.
Yes, you learned.
You know that we, yeah, and so now
old neophyte,
like, okay.
You have to learn. He's only 9. You know?
Totally, we're both neophytes. My husband and I, we are total neophytes, and so now, you know, slowly as time has taught us, okay, you know, maybe we won't buy him the goat 2 days after he expresses interest in having one. So you know,
we spent $300 on a karate uniform that she immediately dropped.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So that, and exactly, we just, our son is really into music, surprise, surprise. And we did not push him in that direction at all. In fact, we almost hindered it. Not because, you know, I think we were so afraid of him feeling pressure from us. So
sure.
We like went to the opposite extreme where he'd be too, you know, and trying to climb up into the piano bench and be like, okay, kid, you know, you figure it out.
Right, sure.
And eventually he really did show
an
interest. But I will tell you that a few instruments have been purchased along the way, and not all of them cheap because we have high standards, and those instruments are now collecting dust in the corner of my husband's studio.
I have a trombone in the shed.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Ah, that, there's a joke in there somewhere. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. So he is showing an interest in music. Did your parents do that with you? I mean, with all of you and your sisters, did they throw something musical at you?
No, there was just a piano in the house, so there was opportunity. And I actually was the 3.5-year-old who climbed up onto the piano bench. And my mom says I started playing Sesame Street by ear and hadn't been taught a lick of music yet. So she said, okay, we're going to put this girl in piano lessons. And so at 4, I started studying, and
who was your first?
I loved it.
Who was your first piano teacher? Just a lady down the block.
Ryan. The lady down the block, and her daughter had this crazy porcelain doll collection. It was like this room full of dolls, which sounds kind of terrifying, but it was bliss. I'd walk by and kind of, you know, rubberneck to try and look at all those dolls as I was walking to the piano, because, you know, I didn't have anything like that in my world. And so that kind of kept me going to lessons. And piano, you know, was more arts and crafts when I was four. It was called the Lila Fletcher method. And we would just cut out all these notes and pictures and accidentals and treble clefs. And so it felt almost like
That's a good way of bringing kids in.
Yeah, it's really it's like very tactile. And of course, playing piano is tactile as well. But, you know, I think for a four-year-old, it was just wonderful that it was like kind of multimedia right from the get-go. Because I think maintaining a four-year-old's focus is half the battle, right?
Sure.
If not the whole battle. But I got bit by the music bug early. Like, I really was so drawn to the piano, that sound, and the way it would make me feel, you know, it was like almost like a possession, you know, the way that music would make my spirit soar, you know, it was really, and I just wanted to be able to do that for other people. By the time I was eight, you know, I was determined that I would want, like, I would be able to make other people feel that way when I played. Uh-huh. That was the dream, you know, that was the big dream.
Sure. So yeah. Do you sometimes sit at the piano anymore just by yourself? I mean, when you're feeling down or quiet and, you know, your husband and your son are out of the house. I mean, do you ever have moments anymore where you'll just sit and I'm sure you have like three or four songs that you'll fall back on and just play for yourself and just play to find your center again?
It's been a while. It's been a while. You know, I wish that I could say yes, but, you know, now in some ways, I mean, there's such joy still in the act of making music, whether it's for myself in the privacy of my own space or if it's sharing with others. But it is a more complicated relationship now. It's hard to strip away the work component, even though I, like, in a way, I get to play for a living. And I mean, play, not play piano, I mean, play in the sandbox. But at the same time, there is that layer of complexity where now it's like, okay, you know, music is work. So sure. I have to, sometimes I think what reinstills that childlike joy, and I've seen it in Sting, and that's been so beautiful. You know, this guy who's now, he's almost 70?
Yeah.
I think he turned 70 this year, and I still see that childlike joy in him that coexists with the uber seasoned professional. And it's often somebody inviting me into something they're working on where I get to take on kind of a new role that's apart from Lila. Like I'm Lila the musician, but I'm functioning in a new way that is kind of entering someone else's orbit. I find a little bit more freedom in that sometimes than being the one who is at the source of creating that musical world herself. Does that make sense?
No. I agree. There's a lot of pleasure in accompanying as opposed to leading.
Yeah.
You know, because your job is just to fill in spaces. That's all it is. You know, find the beautiful spaces in this song and just fill them in.
Exactly. You know?
And it's so elegant. I mean, it's a bit what a drummer has to do. You know, a drummer's job is fill in the spaces. Don't drive the song. Just find spaces in the music, you know.
Yeah.
And I find accompanying is a lot like that. There's a lot of pleasure in it.
Totally. And there's freedom, like, even though your role to some degree is more prescribed, sometimes, you know, there's that concept of freedom within boundaries, which is why I think I love jazz,
right?
You know, because to me, some structure, unless it's free jazz, which is its own animal. But even then, there's still a shape and you find it together. You know, it may appear to be just a cacophony of sound, but there's still some structure in there. So for me, it's like And I guess, you know, and that goes back to what we were talking about with arranging other people's music. I think for me, there's like a lot of room for play within the confines of someone else's song. Whereas if it's a totally clean slate, that can feel more confining to me, oddly. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's kind of paradoxical. Yeah.
No, it's giving your viewpoint on a song, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there are many covers that have become more famous than the original songs, right?
Oh, Suzanne Vega. I mean, that's a great example. I only knew about her music because of that, the remix of Tom's Diner, you know. And you hear the backbeat come in.
Yes, everybody knows
it. You know, and it's like, that's not what the original sounds like.
No. It's an important moment where you can hear something and go, you know what? I think I can add to it. I think I can add to it.
Totally.
You know, and make it my own.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we are over an hour, which means I
know, what fun.
I can edit it down and make a decent show out of it now. So I appreciate your time. It was great talking to you.
You too.
Well, that's it for our interview with Lila Bialy. Thank you for listening in. I want to thank Lila for giving us the time out of her busy schedule to talk with us. You are listening to KBOG Dark Coast Radio 97.9 FM, Band in Oregon. We are going to finish off with a song off of Lila Bialy's latest album titled Out of Dust. This one is called Wendy's Song. Until next time, this is KBOG Soundcheck. Be well and see you next time. From foundation head lay.
Like pinwheels, they cycle round year after year. So many stories for the telling, and the dreams that brought a heat.